Hello, this is Jonathan Rosen. Dean Martineau gave up a potentially lucrative career in the law to teach people about using blindness-related technology with software applications and to produce some pretty interesting magazines as well. Why did he do it? Well, on the Blind Line of the 2nd of October 1999, I spoke with Dean about this and other issues. We began by discussing the question of how he got into computers.
I used to live outside the U.S. I came back to the States in 83, got a job in 84 at a rehab, sort of a pan-disability facility in the city I was living in, and they had this grant. They were going to buy some equipment, and they were going to buy an Opticon. Well, small detail, nobody knew how to use an Opticon, and I researched it, and getting trained on how to use an Opticon wasn't covered and was going to be expensive. So I pointed out to the folks involved here this was not a great move, even though Opticons had their place, and I was hearing about these computers. Now, I remember my wife and I, a couple years previous, having this discussion. We knew one friend who had a computer in 1982, and he was an oddball, and we couldn't imagine ever wanting one. But since then, I started kind of understanding that maybe there were a few good reasons to have a computer. So I was able, on work time, to make gobs of phone calls and do a gobs of research and get my first Apple IIe, which I loved, and my first version of Braille Edit version, what was it, 2.45, I think, with the Echo, and went from there. I knew I was hooked. We live in a part of the world here where it's often cloudy. Summer is wonderful, and winter isn't extreme, but it's just kind of cloudy and sort of blicky all the time. And I knew I was hooked when the computer was going to be coming. It was the first spring day. It was a wonderful night. It was the first summer night. It was hot. The rest of the family went to the pool, but I got a chance to go to the nearest community college and play with the computer for a couple hours in preview of what we were going to be getting, and I chose to do that, so I knew that was kind of an omen of what was going to happen down the road.
Of course, those were the days when we used to be envious of people who had Apples with 128K of RAM instead of...
Oh, I know. My first one had 128K. Of course, You couldn't really use all 128K of it, mind you. That was... I don't know what that other memory was, but most of it wasn't really using. And it's big two-disc drives, you know.
Yes. And yet, you know, Braille Edit was a very powerful package. If you actually take out the kind of clunky technology aspect of it, it really did a lot for its time.
It did. It was a good program, and of course, giving access to Braille and print, we had the wonderful Cranmer modified Perkins Brailler, which was just annoying as all get out. But hey, you could get Braille out of it. That was better than anything else that I could figure out at the time. And so that was my first system, and I stuck to that a little longer than I like to admit. But it also kind of, I started doing some training. Dipner dots fascinated me There's a pattern that will kind of run through this, and that is I really like to find ways where people can do things as affordably as possible. And for those of you who don't know what Dipner dots is, because it's not exactly much people care about anymore, it was a way of taking a daisy wheel printer, which used to be the vogue form of printers, and making a few modifications to the platen and producing a form of Braille. It wasn't terribly reproducible Braille, but hey, it worked if you got it working. And I remember I wrote an article for something National Braille Press put out on Dipner dots at some point or other. Didn't have got enough research. But that kind of got me into training and a little bit of trying to help other people catch on to certain aspects of computers. And so I hung on to that until like 1991, believe it or not, way after it was out-of-date technology, before I finally moved on.
And so at this stage, you were really using computers as a tool for work as opposed to... instructing people in the use, is that right?
Well, it started out that way, but of course part of work was helping other people use the computer when they wanted to, and a lot of seniors who didn't, but a lot of others did. And then somewhere around there, we spent an obscene amount of money on a credit card and bought a home computer, the same system, which now, you couldn't even buy it now, and you wouldn't want to. And so I adopted my learning style that I still have, which is to just spend countless hours frittering around and figuring out ways to do things. And I did home and personal use and also was getting into, as I say, through both work and home, because they were sort of interrelated almost, doing some instructing.
And when did you realize that it was time to go to the DOS world?
Oh... I don't exactly remember how I was forced into abandoning Braille Edit, which I just clung to because it, and it was a nice solid program, although once I left it, I couldn't imagine having to put up with a 4K buffer for all my searches. I don't know how I ever put up with that, but I did.
Of course, there was Bex before after that, wasn't
there?
That's
right, it was Bex. Well, yeah, yes. I was a beta tester for Bex, and I wrote did some writing for the Raise.computer newsletter on different things you could do with Bex, and those were sort of fun days. And did a little bit with Transcribex to help some people get into Braille transcription. It was just time. I wanted to get into doing some sales and training, and I did manage to finally, it finally got through my head that it was time to move on beyond this. So got your basic 286 with an 80 meg hard drive, but that was and 1 meg of RAM I think it had. Larry Skutkan, I had gotten some of his material. Somewhere in the middle of all this, I made a really bizarre career decision. My life doesn't have to make sense to anybody except me, and it sort of makes sense to me, and it definitely won't make sense to anybody else. I thought erroneously that I wanted to get a law degree, and so I got a law degree. Couldn't stand it. Don't practice law, except for the practice of mediation. There's not much that's tangible career-wise that I got out of that, but I got some equipment out of it. Got a grant. Got a Braille and Speak. Got a Braille Embosser at the time. Got some telecommunication software for the Apple. So that night got me online, which I certainly have continued doing until this day. So somewhere in there, it just became real obvious that it was time to move on.
Yes, you would have been at the period in study then when computers were just starting to really make a significant dent in the workload of blind people and make a real contribution to their studies.
Definitely. My story, well, a couple of stories. I mean, the fact of being a law student, one of the things they do is they give you a free access to, in the States, I imagine this happens other places to some degree, they give you free access to Lexis and Nexus and Westlaw.
Isn't that lovely?
I didn't do a heck of a lot of studying after I figured out that law school wasn't what I was interested in, but I certainly did an awful lot of reading of newspapers on Nexus, you could do as much as you wanted and nobody cared, because of course they want you when you leave law school to adopt this as your system and spend all kinds of really expensive money on it. So I did that, and then I remember undergraduate days. Well, then when I finally, kicking and screaming, decided to take the bar exam that gives you the theoretical right to practice law, it was too late to get the 600 page materials transcribed on tape, even if it had been possible. So I had a scanning system by then, and so I scanned the thing, turned it into about 1,800 pages of Braille, without a lot of time involved, but very doable, and was able to actually pass the exam. And I attribute the fact that I was able to study in Braille was one of the primary reasons I was able to pass that exam on the first go round. So, yeah, the technology really, at that time, the late 80s, early 90s, computers were really starting to have a big impact, and the DOS screen readers were catching up. To the point where they could really handle the things that were out in a lot of occasions. I mentioned Larry Skutkan. His first DOS screen reader was he came out with that, and his marketing and the fact that the way he described it was one of the things that kind of helped me realize that I probably could vault into DOS, and sure enough, that happened.
You chose to not proceed too much further after getting a law degree. Where did you head then?
Well, I was in a situation, and I've been very fortunate in a lot of respects. My situation kind of changed. I needed to earn some money, but not make a killing, which is a fortunate situation as far as I'm concerned to be in. And so, I did a certain amount of computer sales and that sort of thing, adaptive equipment. I sold a few systems. Somewhere in this process, actually during law school. After I had my Braille and Speak and was all excited about it, I called Dean Blasey one day and said, "Dean, I think we ought to have a users group for the Braille and Speak." Well, he thought that was a wonderful idea. And therein was the birth of Battery High, which of course being the opposite of Battery Low, which is the warning you get from Braille and Speak. That was the users group newsletter that some of you got copies of probably. They used to send me lists from Blasey of anybody who had purchased a unit in the last year, and anybody who had done that got a free copy of the magazine or two. It rather sporadically appeared, but the combination of that, some technology sales I did found some training opportunities to do some teaching locally. And during this time, I also have had a career doing some mediation training. So I sort of had these parallel careers going, neither one of which were making me wealthy, but I had figured that was not my life's goal anyway. Gradually, you still there?
I am.
Good.
Marvelous technology, this.
Gradually, the technology has taken a higher, I've been doing more of it, trying to make more of a living with the tutorials and the magazines. Again, not getting rich, but again, that isn't my life's goal, and so is, and our family, luckily, we're able to kind of, we've agreed that works.
But that is an interesting thing, because with a law degree, presumably if you were to hunt and be persistent, you may be able to find some pretty lucrative work. What keeps you motivated in being involved in sort of on the fringes of the access technology industry, which obviously isn't bringing in a lot of money?
No, not much at all. It's just not the way I do it. Well, two things. Number one, as far as the law degree, the more I learned about it, the more I realized that it wasn't something I wanted to do. Just as a matter of principle, I don't like most of it. I'm glad somebody else does. There's a lot of need for advocates out there. However, I'm not going to be one of them. Mediation is a great area, has a lot of potential as a method of solving disputes. I have enjoyed doing some work in the training end of that. However, it just never quite... If I was going to do mediation as a career, it would have been as a family mediator. You don't do that by yourself. At least I don't think you do it by yourself effectively. And no partnership arrangements, despite the fact that I searched for them, ever really worked out. So that was part of the reason. Also, I enjoy what I do. One of the things, as I go through life, I'm discovering that I tend to be kind of a loner by and large. I tend to do best on my own, and I enjoy creating my own materials, working one-on-one or one on small group with people, and then also creating my own materials. So I guess that's as much of an answer as I can give.
How did you get involved in the tutorial business?
Well, it was a fairness issue. There was a gentleman, and I won't say the name, but a lot of people know him. He's a nice person. He was, and I probably does much more competent work than I've ever considered doing, who was creating tutorials in the 90s. And they cost anywhere from, I don't know, was it $75 to $125 U.S. for these tutorials. Now, probably if a person was really going to make a significant living, that's what you'd have to charge. But I thought it was significantly unfair that blind folks had to depend for third-party computer instruction on that kind of priced material when sighted folks can go down to their local bookstore and for somewhere between $10 and $30 pick up a perfectly good and usable book that will teach them. And even tutorial material wouldn't have needed to cost that much. So that kind of drove me, I think, to a degree, that I really felt that there was probably a market for it. I think the first thing I created, I don't remember if the first thing I created was a Braille and Speak tutorial or a DOS tutorial. It's sort of faded now. It was sometime in the mid-90s. But, I was enjoying doing the Braille and Speak newsletter, even as sporadically as I was doing it, and getting some good feedback from people that led me to some training opportunities. And so That, as best I can recall, that was one of the big factors. I felt like there was a real fairness issue here, that blind folks already had a few deficits in terms of what kind of training, what kind of opportunities we have for the computer. Great as it is, a lot of people don't have it at all, and a lot of other people may be able to get the equipment but have a hard time learning it for one reason or another.
Do you think the same sort of fairness issue surrounds the price that most screen reader vendors charge for their product?
Well, yes and no. I mean, it'd be nice if we could pay, we can pay $50 for a screen reader, except that I'm afraid that the screen reader that's currently available for that price is hard for a lot of people to use. Those companies have to make a living. I certainly can't fault them wanting to make a living at the business, and that's sort of the way it works. I think it would be nice if there was another way. That doesn't mean that everybody in the screen reader business, I think, is totally fair and totally interested in the consumer, because I don't think that's the case. But I think it's just kind of life in the situation we're in. I don't know any other way to do it right now.
And did the tutorials meet with the success that you were anticipating?
Yes, they have, and I think that if I was a little bit more efficient as a business manager and marketer, and I would probably, they'd probably even meet with more success than they do. I have a lot of repeat customers. That's what indicates to me that they're successful, is when I come out with something, people seem to want to buy it. That's when I decided to put up a magazine out here. That was the big test. You know, a lot of people will pay $20 for something once. The question is, are they going to pay $20 for it again? And a high percentage of the subscribers did. So, yeah, I consider it successful.
How many tutorials have you produced now?
Well, again, counting and remembering, are we in the up around 20? I don't, there's a bunch of the older ones that nobody really buys now. I'm always amazed. It's a total windfall profit when everybody wants to buy a DOS tutorial at this point. Every once in a while, somebody does. So probably we're up in around the 20 or so.
That's quite a prolific output, though, isn't it? Because tutorials take a long time to produce.
Well, they take a long time to produce, especially my big quandary is I have to sit around and figure out what I'm doing, and I'm never sure I know what I'm doing. I never think I know enough to produce a tutorial. Eventually, I just have to sort of say, you're going to have to just start talking, you know, and get this thing done, because, and I've seen also some other books that have, some of the material that's out there in the computer market, it isn't perfect either. Some of it's very good. A lot of it's very good, but it isn't perfect either. There are things that I would do differently, or things that I see that maybe they left out. So it takes a long time for me to do the learning, because I'm basically doing that on my own. I've very seldom taken any kind of classes or anything, or had anybody jumpstart me in anything. I'm just kind of figuring it out on my own. And we're only as effective as the tools that we use. Unfortunately, Windows was slow for me to get into. One reason was that I was using a screen reader, which was very deficient. And when I got a hold of another screen reader that wasn't deficient, I realized how much that was causing my trouble.
Are you going to name names?
I'd rather not. I have a lot of regard for the people that produced that screen reader, but it just never was. You know, I don't want to. They're good folks, but unfortunately,
I understand.
The screen reader just didn't measure up.
Sure.
And I had to abandon it eventually.
What's the skill? What are the skills involved in imparting this knowledge? Because I imagine that if you're producing tutorials, you probably have a kind of a natural aptitude for computers. But then, not everybody has the ability to clearly communicate those skills to other people. And it must be quite a major business to try and think about what questions are people likely to want the answers to, and how do I best explain these things?
I agree. I think, in fact, this discussion came up on the GW Micro list. Somebody, some organization somewhere, they didn't want to name where they were, is putting out, they wanted a little list of questions so they can evaluate somebody's ability to teach WindowEyes. And somebody else on the list rightly pointed out that having the specific knowledge of how to, you know, change the volume and how to bypass a WindowEyes keystroke onto your application is a real small part of what teaching is, because a lot of people can get that knowledge, and it's also knowledge that if you don't have it, you can get it back real quickly. I think a lot of it has to do with organizing, and you know, what comes first, what comes next, what do people need to know in what order. And I try, and I succeed to a good degree, and people remind me when I don't succeed, to make the stuff understandable, you know, get away from the jargon, explain, you know, why these things are important. You know, why do we really care about Windows Explorer? What's it good for? You know, what's it going to do for us in the great scheme of things? You know, what's Windows 98, for that matter, going to do for us? You know, why do you want to know this? And what's the point? So, I think it gets into use of language. It gets into organization and trying to pace as much as possible so that people can make sense of it. There's also, you know, little technological things, mixing in the sound and all that kind of thing. But I'm not any kind of a high-tech engineer on that at all. My material is usable, but certainly not professional quality.
I am quite interested, though. What sort of equipment are you using to produce the tutorials?
Well, I've actually used a couple of different recorders, and one of them might surprise you. The APH Handy Cassette 2. I went through a phase of producing them in four-track format, which actually was an accident. I started recording one day, and then I came back and was kind of perplexed because how is this happening that this tape, and I realized this was like, I had recorded this in 15/16. I hadn't planned to, which was, of course, really a dumb mistake to make, but while I was at making that dumb mistake, I realized I was able, with a handy cassette, to produce a good tutorial on 15/16. Since then, I've decided not to do that for two reasons, well, a couple of reasons. The biggest one being a lot of people really want, especially people outside the U.S., but even some people inside the U.S., like to receive material on standard speed tapes. So I'm using a Marantz, I think it's a 303, which is not the higher-end Marantz recorder. It only has two heads, doesn't have three, so I can't monitor exactly what the recording is going to sound like, for instance, but I didn't feel like that was really necessary in my case. A Radio Shack microphone and a little Radio Shack four-channel stereo or mono mixer. I usually use the double talk, although when I demonstrate JAWS now, I use Eloquence because I'm really impressed with that, and I'm really pleased that JW Micro has managed to make Window Eyes work with another software synthesizer. It's not a highly usable software synthesizer for me because the rate on it is way too slow, but for demonstration purposes, I think it has some real value.
And how do you get on for duplicating the tutorials when you need to send them out?
Well, I've got a couple of Telex duplicators, one that's a stereo that I use for most of the tutorials, and then I've, not horribly long time ago, acquired a mono one, they're a lot cheaper, which I use for the magazine and for anything I can get away with, you know, any mono material. And the whole combination seems to work fairly well. As long as I keep the duplicators maintained, I'm getting relatively few complaints about the tapes these days. So the Telex duplicator, somebody tried to sell me a much more expensive one. I'm sure it might be nicer, but the Telex duplicator is, nowadays they've now made them reasonably quiet. They have erase heads, which are kind of nice, and Long's Electronics. If you need to buy anything, I don't get any money for this, but if you're in the U.S., other vendors don't quite understand how Long's Electronics out of somewhere in the South manages to sell their equipment quite as cheaply as they do. So it's a pretty good place to go. Nothing fancy as far as the equipment goes, but it seems to get the job done.
This is often the case. I think people would be quite surprised if they saw what's running in here. Are you looking at alternative delivery mechanisms, for instance, with the age of CD burners now, the compact disc, or perhaps even delivery over email in Real Audio or MP3 to people who purchase them?
Well, I probably need to look at that more closely than I have. One thing, the cost of media is simply a little bit more using CD, and that's one reason I haven't been excited to look at that. I haven't found CDs for any cheaper than $1 U.S., and my tapes cost about half that much. Now, there'd be some nice things that you can do with CD, and that would be a real smart direction to go. I put the magazine in Real Audio, and I have kind of wondered about changing formats to perhaps Windows Media or something, but I think I'm going to stay with Real Audio, probably. It seems to, despite the fact that everybody admits that its sound quality isn't what everybody else's sound quality of the other formats, it's quite popular. Pretty much everybody has it, and so I'm staying with that for the moment. And I'm not averse to other delivery mechanisms for the tutorials, and certainly we'll have to go to that at some point. But I don't know what that point's going to be.
So tell me about some of your latest tutorial products. You just did a Windows 98 one, I believe.
I just did the Windows 98 one. I'm in the middle, sort of struggling with how to do the one that I'm in the middle of right now. I will see how it comes out, and I hope it comes out soon because I've got to move beyond it on Windows Explorer or Internet Explorer. Hmm. Now, obviously, as you can well imagine, the problem with doing a tutorial on Internet Explorer is I make my tutorials typically screen reader independent. Now, some people don't like that, and it's a decision I always toy with because some folks can't handle a lot of other information or even other sounds being thrown at them. They have JAWS, they have, you know, Microsoft Word. They want to know how JAWS works with Microsoft Word. And there's something to that because, especially with JAWS, there are a lot of keystrokes that are built in there that would be handy to be able to teach, that in a screen reader independent tutorial, it's harder to incorporate them as effectively. I usually will do a chapter on each screen reader, but that isn't as good as incorporation. With Internet Explorer, that incorporation is mandatory. And Henry Joyce has kind of helped me out a little bit here by coming out with their public beta. I really wondered how I was going to do this until they came out with their public beta 3.31, but now that that's available, it makes this tutorial a lot easier to do because nobody's going to use 3.3 once 3.31 becomes available, if they sure shouldn't on Internet Explorer.
Yeah.
So that's going on. I'm also, the next thing I'm going to do after that will be the third edition of something that has a market. Basically, I call it Top Introduction to Computer Knowledge, TIC, otherwise known as How Do You Buy a Computer and What Do You Do Once You Get It. This is definitely not for anybody who knows much of anything about computers. It's kind of like, you know, what do all those terms mean? Kind of generally, not even in tremendous amount of specifics, because, I mean, I can only teach what I know, and there's some things about these processors, a lot about these processors and which one you should buy that I don't know. But, you know, how do you make these decisions? And then the next part, I think a lot of blind folks out there still are wondering, you know, why do I really want a computer? What would it be like to have one? And so I go through showing what it's like to word process, what it's like to be on the web, what it's like to read print, with a little bit of interactive demonstrations. You kind of get the idea of what it's like. I'm going to do that one. Then something that I've promised, so I have to get it done, and the fact that I want to, is something that's partly a benefit for Sound Computing subscribers and partly a benefit for everybody else. It's going to be called Top Win Extra, and it's going to be some form of tutorial, as yet not totally figured out, but I have a fair idea of what I'm going to do, along with a CD of speech-friendly freeware, shareware, and demonstration programs. I know that I wanted this. When I got my first computer, it was great. I had this computer. But, of course, I didn't have any kind of unzip program, didn't have any kind of a telecommunications program, and somebody from the local computer club, you know, gave me something that I was able to get online with. I don't remember how this exactly worked, but it's something that I thought was important. So, and there's an awful lot of programs out there. This CD project is something that could be a full-time job for months, going through and evaluating all the programs. I finally had to kind of put a stop to just downloading and trying things out, and I'm going to have to limit myself a little bit to what goes on here. But even so, I think it'll be useful for people to have a good parcel of programs that either somebody or I or both have decided are speech-friendly. That doesn't mean that, you know, you may not find them friendly, but chances are you will.
Yeah, this is a very interesting subject. What constitutes speech friendliness is very much in the eye of the beholder, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it is. And in my case, I don't have an awful lot of patience with these things. So programs that somebody else may be very motivated to make work, unless they've told me they made them work, chances are I'm not going to know it. And so the programs have to work with a relative minimum of tweaking, because I'm not doing much. So that's probably limiting some programs out that actually could be used. On the other hand, it's probably what most people are going to do.
Yes, and it's probably what you need to do if you're aiming at novices who want something to go. Yeah,
unless there's, if the program needs set files or script files, they either have to provide those or they have to come be provided by somebody else. Otherwise, most users aren't going to make set files or script files for things.
How do you counter the view that is still expressed in quite sizable numbers by blind people who say that Windows is still no place for blind people, that it's graphical, it's horrible, give us DOS?
Well, I counter that by pointing out that part of that is an attitudinal consideration. If you're convinced something is difficult, then it probably will be. There was a time, and my first screen reader experience was illustrative of this, that Windows was very difficult, that we didn't have the tools. Now we have the tools, and I mean, we're able to use most of Microsoft Office 2000, which is the current, you know, nice though it may be if people were still using other word processors and if there was other competition out there, the reality is that there isn't. I mean, it's just default behavior. You're going to have Microsoft Word. If you want a spreadsheet, you're going to have Microsoft Excel. And I guess the advantage of that is the screen reader developers can focus on those programs and, to the degree that their screen reader allows them to, make them work. So, and as far as, and you know, if a person can function, and a lot of folks probably can and may want to, they have their own computer, they don't have to do what everybody else is doing, they don't have to do the regular workplace routine. For those folks, if they want to do DOS, that's okay. However, the advantage of multitasking and the advantage of internet audio and the advantage of off-the-shelf OCR are really huge advantages to me. Even though I have to admit that I put up with sometimes levels of access. Oh, I was playing around telnetting somewhere yesterday, and I was noticing that, you know, I wouldn't have tolerated this particular, you know, some of the speech I'm getting. I wouldn't have put up with that in my DOS days. I would have expected a much higher degree of speech. So in some ways, I think I'm putting up with a little bit lower, and maybe it's just that I'm not willing to spend the time tweaking, and I spent some of that time with the DOS program. I sort of think that we do put up with perhaps a little bit clunkier access, but by and large, it's worth it.
Yeah, well, Tony, it's a particularly good example because certain screen readers don't work too well with terminal emulators at all.
No, I think that's the case. And I've made no effort to make it better. And had I made some effort to make it better, I think that it might have been better. But, you know, folks, obviously the reality is DOS, while, you know, there's still a core of people, and not all of them blind, who definitely stick to DOS. There are news groups, and there is a little bit of DOS program development being done. If you plan to be, you know, in the world with anybody else, you're probably not going to get too far that way. And Windows isn't that difficult. I don't think of it as graphical. I mean, it is graphical, but I don't have to think about that. I don't really. I have a rough idea of what's going on the screen, and I convey that to other people, you know, when I talk to them and in my tutorials, but it's not that necessary, as far as I'm concerned, to worry about it. You just learn what you need to know, and you do it.
It's interesting, though, that Linux is becoming increasingly trendy.
Well, it is. However, I have to wonder, while it's... Linux is kind of a minefield. You can cause yourself lots of problems in there. I think that it's a great idea, and there are some blind folks, and I don't know if that number is increasing very fast, that are getting involved with it. There's certainly some mailing lists, and there is some access technology available. Part of the reason for that, of course, is for Linux's popularity is a backlash against Microsoft, which is certainly understandable, and I hope it continues. And there are a couple other operating systems that I know even less about that are not totally dead, but I just don't know that for most blind users, unless you've got some help or unless you're a bit of a technician, I don't know that Linux is really the direction to go.
So tell me about Sound Computing, which is very much a thriving enterprise, at least by the sound of how it's all going for you on the website there.
Well, again, one fine day, I kind of missed, you know, I was going back and forth, was I going to keep doing battery high or not, and I finally realized, based on the fact that I wasn't ever getting it done, that I wasn't going to do battery high, you know, that the world wasn't heading in the direction of the Braille and Speak, although it's... Despite that fact, that little device is still used by an awful lot of us, I think, or one of its Braille display versions. But there isn't a whole lot of development going on there, and I'm not sure that I don't think there ever really will be. I thought I'd sort of float up this flag and see if anybody would salute trying out a computer magazine. And I'm modeling it after Playback. A lot of folks are going to be familiar with Ed Potter's Playback magazine, which is an consumer electronics magazine for blind folks. It's been around since about 1980 or 81, I think, and if not even before that. I don't do anywhere near as good a job on it as Ed does on his, although he speaks highly of it to me. The idea is to try to get people to submit articles to make it really a consumer magazine from all standpoints. In other words, folks find something they like and they talk about it, they review it, they do a little bit of teaching, and I just kind of put it together. That hasn't happened to the extent that I would like yet, although I do have material from other people in just about all issues. But, again, it seems to be meeting a need. There's, between the two formats, cassette and real audio, it's gradually growing, and it seems to have a bit of a niche. Of course, we'll have some competition. American Foundation for the Blind is going to come out with a magazine. It's rather interesting. All three of us, Peter Shelley, Ed Potter, and I, who produce these little consumer magazines, we all exchange our magazines around among each other. I wrote to the folks from American Foundation for the Blind asking if they'd be interested in doing a magazine exchange and didn't hear back from them.
Yeah, I've read about what they're up to a little. Is that going to be on the net or just on cassette, or what are they planning?
I think you'll have a choice. I think it'll be email, disc, cassette. Email, disc, Braille. I don't think it'll be cassette. If I remember right, email, disc, Braille, and large print, I think, are the formats, but I'm not positive. So they're going to actually write their magazine, which is more than I do, or any of the rest of us do, for that matter, that are producing these audio magazines. I don't write anything, incidentally. My tutorials are totally off the cuff, and so is the magazine.
Hmm.
So So I don't know. It'll be interesting to see. Of course, I think there's probably a market, and they certainly have a wide ability to get to a lot of people with their magazine.
And yet, there's something about, for instance, hearing a speech synthesizer being demonstrated or something like that, that it certainly means that you've still got a market there. And in fact, Newsbits was incredibly popular, the magazine.
That was very popular, and that's. I'm, you know, one of the successors to that. Rich Ring came out with his magazine after that, and then he wasn't able to do that anymore, and then Peter filled the niche, and I decided to try filling it as well. Yeah, I don't anticipate an awful lot of decline in subscriptions when that magazine comes out, at least not initially.
How do you think, in general, blind people are coping with streaming audio? Do you get a lot of technical questions about why they can't hear your audio and that kind of thing?
Well, some. I haven't gotten very many for a while, so apparently there was, I think some of the problems were related to my ISP. Most times when I do my HTML coding properly, and that does not always happen, I haven't had, you know, haven't had complaints for a while. So it either means nobody's listening to anything, or that they're able to get it okay. For subscribers, I did start giving them a zip version of the whole magazine that they can download, which means they don't have to cope with anything other than a big download, and that's kind of nice. I think, you know, as streaming audio gets more used, and of course your PC audio list has helped with that. I've noticed that the list has kind of changed character over the months, as a lot of the basic questions seem to have been largely resolved, and of course between that and the Here Today site, some of that information is pretty readily available to people now. So, yeah, I find that blind folks are getting more sophisticated with it, and that more and more, and then there are some of these sites also, like, between the PC audio, the e-groups online chat, and also I suspect that the folks at, and my mind is blank, that George Bai's group, Audio Tips, all of these little tech support mechanisms, these little help mechanisms that we've got set up, are helping people to make use of this technology.
And yet I imagine there's still a huge number of blind people who have the potential to go online who are not online for whatever reason, and the challenge is to somehow reach out to them.
I think that's well, of course, outside the U.S., that's enormously true. Of course, there's a lot of huge population of folks who don't even have computers. To me, that's the biggest population, and the computer isn't even the problem right now. I mean, you can get a Windows-based computer if you look around. If you don't pay attention to the monitor, you could probably get a perfectly satisfactory in Windows-based computer in North America for $400 or $500. The trick is the adaptive technology to go with it. And as I say, I just don't see an easy way around that. Until I don't know when. I just don't see how that the problem is going to be solved. I'm sure there are a lot of folks who could be online who aren't. I think they're gradually coming. That's of course true of sighted computer users as well. There's a population that just hasn't made the plunge yet. And, of course, there could be some blind folks whose spouses have America Online, which is not the most helpful way to get online, and therefore that could be a barrier to them as well. But, again, in North America, while I'm not sure, I just read an article recently saying that the free Internet service provider idea isn't going to work, it still seems to be working. You can get on with Net Zero quite successfully and throughout a large portion of the U.S., and not just pay anything for internet access if you want to. So it's still possible.
Well, things are getting better because we were speaking with Sergio Amirata last week, who, of course, is selling Simply Talker for $50 US. So, and that's got software speech and things built in, so definitely things are heading in the right direction.
It is, and I really wish that program could progress more. My feeling looking at it, though, is I'm not sure. It's kind of like a shortwave radio. If you're a novice user, you really need a good shortwave radio in order to be able to get as much of the band as you can get. The one you can probably go out and buy for $30 or $40, you may be rather disappointed with it. I'm afraid the same thing applies to that program, and I wish it didn't. I'm not sure that a novice user who can't afford another kind of screen reader, I'm not sure how far they'll get with that program. I hope that doesn't remain the case.
And then, of course, there'll be things like the narrator function in Windows 2000, and I presume it will be in Windows Millennium as well, that will at least give people speech of a kind, even without a screen reader, not to really be able to use products like Word or anything like that, but at least to perhaps get their computer up and running.
Well, any little bit helps. It's kind of amusing that they don't make it possible to use their own Microsoft products, but I mean, that's part of the Microsoft mystique that a lot of us haven't understood for a long time, how apparently that company, they really don't work too well even internally together.
Well, I suppose this is the thorny debate, though, about whether, in fact, blind people want Microsoft to enter the screen reader business or not.
Right, and I don't know. I don't know where you fall on that. I wouldn't mind seeing them devote their not inconsiderable resources to putting out a really good screen reader. I mean, I don't think that's a... I'm not sure that would be a bad thing. Now, of course, if they devoted their not inconsiderable resources to putting out a mediocre screen reader, I probably wouldn't like it a whole lot. But, I mean, they have resources that make the largest adaptive technology, you know, screen reader maker look like a tiny little company that they really sort of are. So, I don't know. I don't know how to come down on that one. I don't like to see these small companies be stamped out, although quite frankly I see some of them sort of fading just based on their own qualifications, whereas there's been a lot of screen readers. I'm not sure that how many of them right now are really viable in terms of keeping up with what's going on. Certainly on the web I see two that are really, really functional, and then there's a significant drop off.
There are probably only about four screen readers that are really worth anything at the moment in the Windows area.
Well, yeah, how many... That's probably, I think that's probably pretty accurate, and I'm not even sure the number is that high.
So,
you know, because I mean, it's very hard for these companies to, with you know, small numbers of staff, and then the tech support demands. I think a lot of people complain about Hender Joyce tech support. Well, I think that if any of the other screen reader vendors had managed to have the marketing success that Hender Joyce has had the number of users out there. Also, parenthetically, if their screen reader did have a few of the problems that Hender Joyce builds in, like their copy protection scheme, but I don't know if the other companies could keep up with the demand of the tech support would be if they had the number of copies out there. So it really is a rather labor-intensive business, and I think I see some of the companies kind of falling behind.
In the U.S., do you believe that most blind people have access to quality instruction in the use of their screen reader with specific applications?
No. And as a matter of fact, that's another little venture I'll mention that we're trying to get going. Ed Potter, again, has been sort of behind, has thought about this for a while. You have folks who, maybe they managed to get a system. The training that they get varies from state to state, and of course it depends even if you're a client of any of the agencies, because a lot of folks aren't, unless they're specifically in the job market. They may not even be a client of any of the state rehab agencies. And so there you are. You've got this computer system. If you're not inherently gifted at figuring this stuff out and not good at reading manuals, and if you have maybe a little bit of phobia about it, which certainly is not limited to blind folks to have that kind of phobia, you're in a difficult situation. Ed talks about one recent case. Somebody bought a computer with all the bells and whistles, hired some person who happened to be a blind person to come out and train them. Paid 4 hours, which was not cheap. I think it was $50 or $60 an hour. The person only stayed about 3.5 of those hours, however, because the person had to rely on some form of adaptive paratransit, and the paratransit showed up early. And during that time, the trainer, him or herself, was apparently somewhat mystified about the system. And the ultimate result was the trainee didn't feel like she got much out of it, ended up selling the system. I don't think that's an isolated event, and it highlights a bunch of problems. One thing that we're trying to do to solve this, National Braille Press is working on putting out a book called One-on-One, which allows anybody who is a trainer to list themselves, their credentials, and their price. Part of the hope of this is that folks will have access to some training resources, and that perhaps some of those resources will be at a price that they can afford. Some of those people might be willing to train by phone or in person, depending on, you know, where you are, so that hopefully there will be more training available. We don't know how it's going to work yet. We'd like to get a few more submissions to the guide than we've gotten so far, but we're not giving up, and we expect to get a lot of trainers to submit between now and when we hope to publish. But I'm compiling this, so anybody wants to talk to me about it, I'd be happy to get some email.
And you've obviously got a number of interesting projects then planned for the future. It's obviously something that you, a niche that you've called your own and are doing very well at.
Well, I'd like to have the time, if I ever get these tapes done, I'd like to produce some Braille. I have a concept of a of a one-volume Braille book that's designed for the Braille user, so it doesn't have a whole lot of verbiage, because the problem with Braille, of course, is if you're going to make any money on it at all, you have to. It can't be a real large book. I mean, National Braille Press is non-profit and heavily subsidized. That's how they're able to sell what they sell at the prices they sell it for. But I really like to knock out some Braille material. There's nobody else putting out, you know, concise, something between a reference guide and a manual, so that it's either it can supplement my tapes, or it can be used on its own, or both, whatever people want to do with it. So that's a goal I have that I haven't achieved yet at all.
And so how do people find out more about the tutorials and sound computing and things that you're offering? You have a website there.
I have a website. I haven't bothered doing what you did not too long ago, and haven't bothered acquiring my own domain. So we still have www.eskimo.com/tilde, that's the little key, shift of the key to the left of the one on the keyboard, /tilde, DEAMAR. And, of course, you can email me at DEAMAR@eskimo.com, which is a little easier to remember. And North America, and I guess increasingly internationally, people can call on Pacific Time at area code 425-335-4894. Good chance you'll get voicemail on that, but I will get back to you.
Maybe we could have an Internet Radiothon fundraiser so that you can get your domain name.
Sounds good. Yeah, that has great potential. So
we'll open the pledge line.
yeah, that'll be a great topic for the rest of Blind Line here, is getting the pledge line going on that. But
from what I hear about what goes on in the U.S., we won't invite Jerry along.
No, I think we'll pass on that.
Yeah,
that's something you miss out on in New Zealand. That's one of our little cultural phenomena here in the U.S.
Yeah. Well, from what I've heard, that might not be a bad thing that we miss out on it.
I think you're really fortunate.
Dean, it's been a pleasure to speak with you, and we'll look forward to continuing issues of sound computing and your tutorials, and no doubt we'll have you on the program again.
Well, I appreciate that. I appreciate the opportunity. I think your program is obviously unique and doing a great service, and I'm honored to be able to be a guest.